Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being with us, and certainly we expect some more folks coming in as they can. At this time, on August 3rd, 2015, at a little after 5 o'clock, I call our City Council work session to order for the purpose of discussing the Jim Lakes Extension Roads report and to answer technical questions regarding the report. Mr. Kemp, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and through you to the members of the City Council. As all of you know, on the 27th of July, I was in receipt of the final report from Mr. Rick Toole in Wilmer Engineering dealing with the challenges that we're facing at Jim Lakes. It became very clear to me early on in our staff review of the report, but also the numerous inquiries and questions that we were receiving from the community, that it might make sense to hold a more informal workshop where we would invite Mr. Toole and Mr. Owen from Wilmer Engineering here to explain in more detail their findings and also to respond to the numerous inquiries that we've received from the community. I first join all of our council members in thanking the members of the community who have taken the time to review this report and indicating to us what some of their questions or concerns might be. As a matter of fact, Mr. Decker was kind enough to put together a summary of all of the, or most, if not all of the inquiries that we've received, and that'll actually be the document that we're working from this evening. So out in the audience, if you don't have a list, you don't have a list, I think there are some out on the outer table. So having said that, I know that there are time commitments that both of our, I guess, have this evening, so we are assuming that this meeting is going to be limited to two and a half hours or something along those lines, so you can get off to your other commitments. And there's no expectation on our part that there'll be a decision made by this council this evening or that there won't be a need for additional meetings. But I join every member of this council with our earnest desire to get to the bottom line here and to come to better understand what challenges we face in this neighborhood and thereafter what we might do to assist the neighbors in the area to bring some resolution to this issue. So having said that, if there are no inquiries or questions on the part of the council, I would like to turn the meeting over to Rick Toole and Reed Owen to begin down this list of questions. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Mr. Cohen, manager point. Mr. Mayor, Councilman, here, good to see you.
There you go.
What I'd like to do is just kind of review our approach, what we'd like to do, and how we'd like to proceed tonight, and just to make it efficient to try to go through and still leave time for questions and answers at the end. The first thing we'd like to do is begin by presenting the report itself. Talk about the objectives of the report, how the data was obtained and where, provide some overview of the assessment of the information, look at what our directive was to evaluate the causes of failure, and then provide recommendations on types of repairs that may be considered in the future. The second item we'd like to do is review the observations that we had personally as we evaluated, or we were there when the pavement collapsed, had a failure of the pavement, and the proof rolling truck decided to drop an axle and a wheel right down in the middle of the street, and talk a little bit about that. Third item would be to address the list of questions. Mr. Decker, thank you for putting those in that format. I do appreciate it. We'll try to review them in order so that everybody can follow along. Address all of the questions, and then finally, I need to give you a status of pending information that has been requested and how long it'll take to get some of that, and then finally some question and answers. So as we get started, I'm going to let Reed talk a little bit about the report, but the objectives that were placed before me when we were asked to take a look at that is basically to obtain data relative to the soil and pavement system in Jim Lake subdivision, the extension for Moultrie and Huron Drives, and to assess the reason or reasons for failure and provide recommendations for repair. That's what we have based all of our information on and our approach to this particular issue. So we were not asked to evaluate city standards or specifications, so that's not part of what we've done. We were not asked to evaluate or comment on the construction sequencing or the methodology or results of what the contractor did, because we weren't, frankly, we weren't there. There was no way to make any comments on something we had no personal or direct oversight of. But what we were to do was to report on verifiable data that we could establish through testing and field exploration. So with that, our focus tonight is to present you with actual data that was collected during this investigation and tell you what we come up with as potential reasons for failure as a result of the information we found. So to start off, I'm going to ask Reed to review the report quickly with you, and then we'll move on. Reed?
Mr. Mayor, Mr. Manager, Council, people, and audience, thanks for your interest in the report and appreciate you having us here this evening. The objectives of our report was to go out and cut pavement cores, to look at the pavement thicknesses, and provide access to the underlying soil base and subgrade soils. Once we cut the asphalt, removed it, we performed a Kessler dynamic cone penetrometer on the subgrade and subbase materials to get an idea as to what its strength characteristics and relative density were, and then went back and performed soil test borings at all of the locations selected. We also performed some limited laboratory testing on representative samples that were obtained. There was three sets of laboratory tests performed on the samples, on selected representative samples. Then, as a portion of that, we also reviewed some of the city records that were available to us to kind of get an understanding as to what had transpired during the construction process. From that, we reviewed the data and then prepared the report. Basically, what we found from the soil test point information was that the subgrade conditions were generally very favorable based on the standard penetration testing and dynamic cone penetrometer results. The laboratory CBR was a little low for the type of materials we were encountering. We would have expected something a little bit higher, but it was pretty. Those results were very consistent between the samples that were tested. It's a California bearing ratio test. It is a test procedure in which we compact the sample in a mold. We saturate it back to in South Carolina, their South Carolina DOT says to try to get it to about 95%, get something lower, get something higher, but, and bracket that 95%. So that's what we did with the three samples we tested. Then we take a three-inch piston in that surface area and then load it into the sample. The sample's been saturated for 96 hours, so it's put underwater, saturated for 96 hours. We pull it out. We take that three-inch piston, and then we load it and we record the load and then plot that results, and it's a percentage of a standard value.
Okay, give you a result that indicates whether it's sufficient.
It gives us the support characteristics, the California bearing ratio for that soil. From that, we go into a correlation to come up with a subgrade support value for the material, and then you base your pavement design on that.
So your conclusion overall seemed to be that, I don't want to feed in, what was your overall conclusion about the road?
About the road?
Yeah.
I mean, you had multiple failures, multiple overlays, multiple patches done out there, continued ongoing failures and patches. So in reviewing all the information that's available, we feel that the subgrade conditions, the underlying conditions, are favorable. The water table, the groundwater table, we encountered groundwater at one location. That location, at the time of boring, the water was at about a 9-foot depth. After about 18 hours, it had moved. It had raised to 6 feet, I think it was 6 feet 8 inches below the ground surface. I have gotten a subsequent water level measurement Saturday a week ago, and that was at 8 feet 8 inches below, so it's dropped a little bit. And some of that could have been impacted. It was put in a yard, could have been an irrigation system came on that could have raised it after that 8 feet.
One of the reasons we wanted this test was to get a sense of whether or not why we're having the failures.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not an engineer, I'll make that clear. What I'm hearing what you just said was that the soil itself seems to be fine if you're not finding water until 8 or 9 feet. So then, as an engineer, what would account for all of the failures?
What we have seen in researching the data is that there was the lots out here were graded individually, and there was a pretty substantial amount of grading required for those lots, which would require loading dump trucks and transporting the soil. We think that, combined with some of the other construction traffic out there, allowed the pavement to flex and start cracking, and with those cracks, water was allowed to infiltrate into the underlying subgrade and saturate, provide a thin surface underneath the pavement, which has caused us to continue the failures to continue.
And some of the failures occurred before the heavy construction.
And, you know, there's items out there such as those failures. I don't know what the extent of those failures were. They're not, I just have heard failures. I don't know if they're similar to alligator cracking, if there were pavement marks, or what those failures were. Yes, sir.
No, I'm still.
But there's, you had set basins out there that had to be cleaned out during construction that would have been required heavy truck traffic in there. And I understand there's a wastewater pump station that this may provide access to that would have required some heavy truck traffic going through this area. So it's those types of traffic, as well as the one house that was built out there. I don't know how the contractor staged his equipment and his supplies to build in those houses.
Okay.
I think one thing that also is that there were probably several mechanisms at work in different areas. At Huron Drive, at the lower part where we've read information provided by the owner's engineer, that some failures occurred there before anything started, but they installed some French drain and some water collection devices to collect groundwater. That area was actually along what was previously noted, even on their drainage plan, as a wet area or a creek or an ephemeral type stream that may have had water at different times. So you could have had failures in that area as a result of that water prior to them installing subsurface drainage or some type of French drain to collect and move water through that area. So, you know, this road was there for a good bit of time before everybody moved in. But if you take the two things you're looking at in designing a road, or if you look at a road, how it's going to react, one is the loading on the road, and the second is the soil subgrade characteristics. It's a flexible pavement system, and it's that way for a reason. There are components, and each component, like a chain, have to work. If one member of that chain breaks down, it dies. So if you take the amount of dirt, there's places where there was, you know, 15 to 18 feet of fill moved off of some of those lots. In fact, one of the questions related to a level of groundwater or a level of water seeping out of a hillside in one of those major cuts. It is a major cut. All that material had to be moved. I don't think it was hauled off site. Generally, you balance it because the contractor can't afford to haul everything off and haul back on. So they use it, move it around. There was a lot of fill under the roadway. There's fill on the lots on the south side of the road. From Moultrie Drive and I guess the east side of Huron, a lot of fill as we moved back up in there. So there was a lot of fill moved with heavy, what we call heavy equipment. Anytime you're using grading equipment, if it was dump trucks, they're heavy. A dump truck is probably equivalent to more than 1,000 car passes on the same road. So if you start doing that in lot after lot after lot after lot, all of a sudden the number of traffic applications, they start multiplying.
So is it fair to say from what you're saying that the ground was not too wet for the road, the ground was fine, and that the problem essentially was caused by too much traffic?
Okay, we can't say whether the ground was too wet when they paved or not. Without being there to test that, there's no way. When you do a core, and the one reason you can't test it with a core is because you do, the cores are done wet. They use a wet drilling method because it's a hard steel shell and an 8-inch diameter core. And that 8-inch core has a water spraying around it to keep the bit cool while they go through. So that water immediately gets into the top layer of material. So there's no real way to tell. But if you have construction traffic, if you have had wet subgrade, maybe some of it was wet, and you allowed that asphalt to flex and begin a crack, then you've introduced a location for surface water to get into that base and subgrade material. Once it penetrates and get into, you get what we call a little smear zone, which is right at the interface. And it doesn't take much to allow the pavement to start to flex, and then those cracks begin to spread and become alligator cracks. And an alligator crack is not showing distress. An alligator crack is showing it's already failed. That's the result of a failure. So once you see an alligator crack, everything, that system has failed. For whatever reason, that system's failed, any one of the components.
Does it make any difference if you were to take these soil samples, core, whatever you call them, let's say three weeks with no rain or 2 weeks with rain? Would you expect that to make a difference in what you find?
Not in the core sample itself, because you have to wet drill it. The water's intentionally going to get in there just by virtue of the process you have to go through. Now, you might be able to go in and saw cut a large square out and then go do some undisturbed samples in the middle of that square. That's a quite lengthy and expensive proposition to do, but that would be the only way to tell what the existing water content would be. Wouldn't that be safe to say you could get an existing content, water content, near surface material?
Yeah.
Mr. Miller, if you were saying about
you watched them move the dirt?
Yeah.
Well, I do know that other parts of that subdivision required fill, and I don't know exactly where all the soil went, but I know that it didn't leave the subdivision.
Well, if you look, their house is 10 feet above my house.
Yes.
And the house next to it is about 5 feet above their house. Those lots, I have pictures of it, were 5 feet level all the way across before they started moving the dirt. They dropped my lot into 15 feet, but they just took it with a bulldozer and moved it all over. So that's the only way it didn't dump. And like the first issue we had was the garbage truck coming in there. Garbage truck would go to lot six, Sewer's house, and it backed up my house and picked it up and go forward. We just did not get any traction from that end at all until after y'all told their fault to go ahead and fill those under. I mean, there's no traffic out there.
Let me make a comment here before we have a lot of questions, and we realize that, and we want to hear everybody's points of view. I'm wondering with myself here how the best way to do this is, whether or not to go through this, and everyone, you know, keep their thoughts, and then come up and talk. And we can do it. We can do it anyway. We can do it any way everybody wants to do it, and get through.
We're talking about how the problem develops along the way. Yeah. So would it be more appropriate to let people jump in sequentially?
That's
comments that I frankly don't understand where it makes those comments is coming from.
I think that's fine. I think that's a good way to do it. I just wanted to make sure everyone agreed that we would do it this way, you know, and that's fine. It probably is the best way at the point in time when something is said and it's a comment to be made, if that's okay for council. And, all right, let's do it that way.
Mr. Mayor, maybe.
But one thing you need to do, we need to get this on the table. Are you getting all, can you...
Yeah.
You can't hear from there unless you come up to speak. So, is that okay?
Mr. Mayor, before we begin the public, can we just review a little of the content of the data?
Yes, I that's the purpose here. We need to get through what you have to tell us.
I would like to ask Reed to cover a little bit about the soil borings themselves and the material we found out there. And that, I think that'll tell you a little bit, even the moisture contents that Mr. Warwick had asked about, the moisture content that we were able to recover on those materials.
Typically what we found out there was a fill material. It varied in depth. It was a slightly clay, medium to fine sand, which is generally a good subgrade material, good fill material, that was underlain by coastal plain deposits. The blow counts, standard penetration resistances we got were pretty much all in excess of 10-15 blows per foot, which is high, and it's a medium dense type soil. So that would indicate that the materials were, I can't say 100% compacted or 95%, but they were well compacted materials. And then underlying that, we had coastal plain deposits, which were generally sandy. There were some clays in a couple of different areas, a couple of different sites out there just randomly throughout the roadways. As I say, we did hit water in one of the borings, M7, at a depth of about 9 feet at time of boring. The subsequent water levels were 6.8 feet, and then it's come back down to about 8 foot 8 inches. The pavement thicknesses ranged from 4.75 inches at one location down to 1.2 inches, with an average pavement thickness of 2.9 inches. If you really look, the pavement design called for, the design that was spelled out on the plans was 1.5 inches of asphalt. So most of the locations that we tested exceeded that 1.5 inches. I think it was only four that were 2 inches or less out of the 22 locations that we cored. There were, the average thickness of the pavement was 2.9 inches, averaging all the results. And at one, two, six locations, we found a graded base course underneath the pavement. That was relatively thin, ranging between about 1.25 inches up to almost 4 inches at the locations tested. An average of 2.6 inches of base course. With regards to the moisture contents, the moistures ranged between approximately 10% and 20% on the material obtained at a depth of 1.5 feet below the subgrade. With most of those results near the optimum moisture content, which would be where you'd want to compact the fill soils for the best compactive effort, and most of them were very close to that optimum moisture content. There were some of them that got as high as 20%, but as I say, they generally were close to that optimum moisture. Plasticity and expansive characteristics, generally the soils were low plastic soils, and they did not exhibit a expansive characteristic from the CBR test results. The materials out there that we tested were all that we performed laboratory tests on, which were the materials that were near the pavement subgrade elevation, were all classified as sands, with only about 30% or less passing a 200 sieve, which would make them a silt or a clay. Any questions on the subject?
How would you say overall, good or bad or okay or whatever, everything you've said sounds like it was pretty good.
That's correct.
At least to me, what I think I'm hearing.
It is not what we would have expected.
But does that mean it was good? Were any of those spots that you looked at cracking, or had they been cracked?
There was an array of different, they've been patched. Some were in patch areas, some were in overlaid areas. It was just an array of different. We had,
yeah.
after we did the proof rolling, we found such a variable condition out there with the proof rolling that we may see some deflection for 5 feet and then go another 10 feet and not see any movement. And we may see it on one side of the vehicle, but not on the other side. It was just, it is very sporadic as to how we were seeing movements. So to get a general feel for the conditions, we discussed and decided to select the boarding locations based on random numbers and using the stationing and then go out and measure randomly where those locations were so that we wouldn't be biased by a patch or a failed area.
Okay.
Typically, you don't want to go out to the failed areas because you know you're going to find unsuitable conditions. You want to try to get something that's more representative of the general condition than specifically where a failure has occurred.
What I'm trying to understand is again, what you said sounds to be pretty good, that you ought to be able to run on that and have no cracking. But that may not, it doesn't sound like it's what it is. I mean, would you expect that area to be cracking at some point, alligator cracking or whatever? Or is it already doing that?
It is already alligator cracking, and you patched those areas. And what can happen with these loading conditions is it can take several years for it to finally come to the surface as this pavement deflects.
See, I don't understand that. You're saying its patching's good. Very good.
Based on
I don't want to put words
data,
in your mouth.
Sir.
I don't understand how, if it's so good, how can it move? What causes a crack? If the compaction is great and it doesn't have a lot of water in it,
Well, when you load that pavement, I'm sorry.
Yeah, how did we get to where we are now? The road's literally a mess.
Well, when you load the pavement, that soil underneath, the subbase and the subgrade, is going to deflect. And these pavements are designed for a certain axial loading condition. If you exceed that, you'll quickly get failures in the pavement system. And that's what we believe is because there's some reference in some documents that we saw that indicates that the material was hauled from site to site across the roadways.
Mr. Dwarf, you know, we can play chicken or egg on it, but if you have an inch and a half of asphalt, and that's the strongest layer in your pavement system, underneath that's a base course, and underneath that is a subgrade, and that's a fairly typical residential type of construction. If, in fact, that you have equipment that causes the pavement to flex to a degree, it puts it in tensile strength in the bottom. Asphalt has no tensile strength. If it starts a little crack at the bottom, they say a crack may propagate is about an inch every 6 months or an inch a year. With time. So if you got a little crack down there, it may take a year or longer for that crack to get to the top and actually come through. Now, once it comes through, once there's a crack, once there's an absolute failure in some component, and water can penetrate, and anytime you have a crack, surface water can penetrate that crack and get into the underlying materials. In the case of this area of South Carolina, as well as the like south of Augusta, all of that area in the in the coastal plains area, sand clay is the acceptable base material utilized because it's abundant. And in order to get graded aggregate base, you have to haul it from a Piedmont area quarry. So both states recognize sand clay as a legitimate base construction material. The material we have here is pretty much the sand clay that you'll see not only in embankment construction but also for the base. The problem with sand clay is once water penetrates, if it has any silt or clay in it, and this does less than 30%, but it still has some, you're going to get a softening of that material right at the surface, right at the interface, and that accelerates that failure mechanism tremendously. So if you do have, say, one vehicle exceeds the weight capacity of what needs to be or what the pavement was originally designed for, if one vehicle creates, for whatever reason, and you're going to have some failures in pavements, I think Reed and I were talking earlier, when he was in the private sector side on the building, they estimated 15% failures during construction of the 1.5 inches of material. So you're going to have some. But once you get water that can penetrate that pavement and get into those steep grades where it can run between the interface between the pavement and the base, that all bets are really off, because you're going to have multiple failures. There's no way to get around it. So it doesn't take much to start that propagation if you get in a condition where you can have failures, whether it's settlement of backfill along sewer lines, whether it's compaction wasn't quite up to speed, whether you had moisture in your subgrade or the base material. As the engineers reported, they had wet base and wet subgrades. I don't know what they were referring to, but they said they had wet subgrades when they put stuff down. I don't know how wet it was, the seawater, or was the moisture content high. But anything that would allow deflection of that pavement when it started would allow that crack to form and propagation of that crack up to the surface. And that, like I said, could take up to a year. It could take up 2 or 3 years. In places where they've got patches that are 4 inches thick, it could take 2 or 3 years for that propagation to come up, unless it is just a really serious type of deflection that allows it to move faster. So it is a chicken or egg. Was it too moist when they put it down? I don't know the answer to that, and there's no way to determine it. But the material itself, based on the characteristics we found in the soil test borings, is suitable material for both subgrade and for base material, if it's put in correctly at or near optimal moisture content. And the moisture contents were measured in their investigation at 1.5 feet, just to see what the moisture was. And some of them were on a little high side of optimum, but none of them strayed too far. It really was not what I expected to see, based on what I had heard from various individuals, talking to Mr. Decker out there, from walking the site, from looking at it, looking at water coming up through cracks that were out there. All of those things I expected to see, shallow groundwater and water movement right under the surface, but it wasn't. The groundwater table is different. So what we're saying is that the boring data reflects that the material itself is not poor material. We're not saying that the moisture content wasn't too high when they put it down and it led to premature failure. But we are saying that in absence of shallow groundwater right up next to the pavement, then you've got to look for other mechanisms for failure. So it becomes the chicken or egg. Did the pavement fail first and the moisture get in and create it, or was it wet enough that they started the failure, then additional moisture got in? But regardless, the failure is over material that could be utilized suitably for construction of pavement systems.
I guess the thing that is interesting, there's an addition right across the valley, if you will. Those roads haven't failed, and this is not the only area in that side of town or other areas of town that they haul heavy loads over the roads. And, you know, the standards were, which are come from SCDOT, were incorporated in the city codes in 1987. And I guess the question would be on that side of the town or areas, why the other roads aren't failing in the same manner. And on the other, I mean, it's just, there's some logic here that says, okay, something happened. They haul, I'm telling you, in the neighborhood I am, they move lot to lot, or they'll haul dirt from one street to the next street, and the roads have, they haven't failed yet after, I guess, 12 or 15 years. And so maybe that is the failure mechanism, but goodness, why would it just be on 3,300 feet of asphalt? You can see where that, using my logic.
Yes, sir.
Looking around the neighborhood.
Yes, sir.
How about the spray fields that we were reading something about in all the literature and here in the comments and the seeping? What effect does that have, or could it have had early on?
Try that one.
Well, I mean, part of that same comment was that there were springs. If you look at the soil conservation maps and information, it specifically says that this material doesn't perk well or have good permeability characteristics. So the question would be, why would you put a spray irrigation field? I don't know that you could have gotten that approved as a spray irrigation field, because the ground just doesn't want to accept that moisture. The second thing is if there's springs out there, you've got a certain minimum separation in your groundwater level and the spray application level in order to have it as a spray application field. So you, the springs would have disqualified it from being a spray application field.
But what effect would that have had on it initially? If we go way back to the beginning of this whole project.
With the sandy nature of the soils that are there, there's some clay content, but it's still predominantly a sandy material.
Okay.
It shouldn't have in perpetuity held moisture. That moisture would have wicked through down to the groundwater level.
Mm-hmm.
I know we're in South Carolina, but how far does it freeze? I mean, we've had a couple of pretty good winters, and not just a couple of years ago, but I mean, even before that. How far down does it freeze underneath the soil?
Not as far as Mr. Crimson.
Because up north, that's the failure mechanism. You know, you get water freezes, expands, and cracks.
Our freeze depth, you know, when we design things, we use a 6-inch frost line, even though usually the frost is only, and that includes a safety factor, but your frost line is usually only 2 to 3 inches.
Well, would that be underneath the tar or the surface?
I don't know that I've ever seen it freeze underneath a pavement.
Yeah, I mean, what's going to happen is pavement's going to be dark in nature, so whatever sunlight gets through, it's going to be heat, and there's going to be a certain amount of residual heat that's going to live. I can't think of a situation that I've seen frozen something like that.
Not here. Certainly up north where it freezes down 4 or 5 feet, yeah, but we just don't have enough. I mean, just penetrating pavement would be about the limit of your freeze depth, frost depth.
Okay. Mr. Decker would like to speak.
I'd like to suggest that maybe that they obtain a wireless mic for sessions like this that they could hand around to people instead of having everybody back in and back out. It might be much better for everybody. I don't want to mess up your notes there. Okay. I have a couple of questions for you. One, you say that the base was wet, but you don't know how wet. City engineers said that the streets are continuing to tear up because it was installed with a wet subgrade base. City engineers said that we're paved when the subbase was wet. At least one eyewitness, Mr. Ebner over there, was present and observed these roads being paved when they were wet. What effect would that have on the life expectancy of that road, and would that account for early failures before any truck traffic was on those roads? Because, and what did the city make you aware of this?
Well,
I think we got to switch back, unfortunately. Right. Get that your way.
You've got to have a load on the pavement to cause the flexure for the pavement to actually fail. So just because the subgrade was wet, it wouldn't cause the type of failure. There's got to be a load go across the failure. Increased moisture in the subgrade could cause more deflection of the pavement, which could accelerate that cracking and failure. As far as we stating that the subgrade was wet, we've got moisture contents, but I haven't seen documentation in any of the paperwork that I've reviewed about a wet subgrade other than hearsay on the
that's
questions.
That's not hearsay, sir. That's an email within the city from city engineers stating that. I mean, I can provide you with those emails. The city has those emails, and I'm surprised that you weren't provided with them. Be able to have that information to make your conclusions, because my understanding is that paving on wet subgrade is not the best of ideas and could cause further problems.
Can you answer that?
What's the question?
Is it a good idea to pave on wet surface?
No, it's not. And Mr. Mayor, there's no way for us to tell what the original subgrade, what was wet, and that's like somebody telling me to bring them a rock. I can bring them a rock, but it's going to be the wrong rock. I just don't know how wet the subgrade was when they started. There's no data that's been provided. Visual affirmation of wet subgrade doesn't mean a lot. You'd have to have some type of testing in order to define and quantify what is wet, and is it outside of limits that would result in problems? I just don't know the answer to that.
Sure.
But you don't pave on wet subgrade or wet base.
That's basically where I was getting to. I wasn't expecting you to be there. You weren't there. You couldn't know how wet it was. City engineers said it was that wet, and that the roads were tearing up because it was paved when it was wet. So, and you confirmed that paving on wet subgrade is not a great idea. It could cause further problems. Okay. I don't know. Can you hear that over there? Or?
Sir?
Yeah, I guess we're going to get up here with you here.
You say that that water underneath the pavement.
What question are you
on? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm on question 20, 33. All right.
33,
yeah. The water that you didn't find was found by other people. It was found by radar testing. It was found by CSRA core boring in the road. And I'm wondering if you had those test results when you were determining your...
We did not have the radar data.
Okay.
And we saw where they cored. Now, coring, you're going to get water in the just because of the coring procedure.
Yeah.
It's going to, you use water on the diamond bits in order to keep them cool while you core. So water will get in there.
Okay.
As a result of the coring. Now, with regards to the radar depths, and they're 6 to 8 feet. That's consistent with the water level that we saw have seen out there.
All right. Because there are also people who walk these roads on a regular basis who can tell you that there's water coming out of the pavement at times.
And that can be because...
And, of course, when you're doing your testing recently was a time when there wasn't a lot of rain happening, so I would anticipate that you'd probably have less water.
And there's two waters. There's the groundwater,
right,
which is the deep-seated,
right,
6 to 8 feet, and then the other is surface water infiltration.
Okay.
If you've got a crack up the road and water gets into it, in a crack down gradient, the water's going to come out of that crack, and it's going to travel along the base to come back out. So if you see water coming out during a period of rain, it can happen. That is how some of the water can get under there at 3 and 4 inches.
Okay, you've stated in your report that the subgrade would be compacted to 100%. Did you receive any data from the city that indicated that testing had substantiated that it was compacted properly?
We saw that there was some density testing performed,
but not. We have not seen the data. We have not seen compaction testing data. We have not seen proctor testing data. As a matter of fact,
it was very limited from what I recall.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, what happened was there was a period of time and a number of emails that went back and forth on that about how there was no test data available and that they would get the CSRA testing to write a blanket letter saying that they'd done the testing and everything was okay, which they did, and they accepted that. But there was no proctor test results, which are supposed to be in there. There's also no, to the best of my knowledge, there was never any testing to establish whether the pavement itself, the macadam, was tested to see if it met type 3, which Rick has indicated is an obsolete standard, but there's no testing of the macadam, you know, and all of these factors. And were you provided information, were you provided satellite pictures of that road prior to the housing going up?
I think we had one picture that was after the first house was built.
Yeah. Were you able to observe that there was multiple patching and a lot of patching on those roads at that point in time?
Not with the picture we had.
Well, the pictures that I've supplied to the city certainly showed that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what I'm trying to establish is, were you given enough information? What information were you given to be able to reach your conclusions? Because you're concluding something that the roads were in, that it was primarily due to construction traffic that this was happening, and yet I think everybody in this council room has seen emails that I've sent out with pictures of the patching that was on that road prior to one house. And prior to that, there were several reports on the road failing before there was any traffic on that road. I mean, within 6 days of that pavement going down,
6 days, they're already in there repairing it.
And what was the extent of those repairs? What type of repairs were they doing? Was it a rolling mark in there? Was it that they? One of the things that can cause cracking is simply the rolling patterns that you use. If you don't properly compact it, you don't properly roll it, you can get cracking in the pavement surface.
Would that information not have assisted you in determining what the cause was if you knew what the problems were?
The more information I have, the better it is.
I asked for that information presented to test that the amount of patching and the amount of repairs and the time sequence that those repairs happened from the contractor, so we could establish that this road was actually breaking up long before any construction was made. And I certainly, I don't know, I'm not an engineer either, but I mean, I certainly concur with you guys that certainly putting construction traffic on a road would be bad, but on a defective road it's already breaking up and in patches is a disaster.
I think the pictures that you sent out in the past couple of days, mm-hmm. show the Google
right.
satellite photograph showed the patches near the sed basin in the lower portion of the site, and that was an area where some of the communications we've seen indicated along Huron Street that they had installed an underdrain system. So that could have been a high groundwater table that you needed to pull the water table on. Plus, also, it's adjacent to the detention basin, and that detention basin requires certain maintenance and clean-out, mm-hmm. which would have required bringing in heavy equipment and bucking out of that and hauling off material from that basin, which all would have been traffic loaded, heavy truck traffic loading on that pavement before home construction. Because the site sat there for, 2 years? Those basins would have been in there for 2 years and would have required periodic maintenance.
We also had the sanitary sewer lift stations that require continuous maintenance. Mm-hmm. And those trucks are not light. They're not little trucks, the ones that pull the pumps and do maintenance for, I don't know the exact truck they use for Aiken for that particular location, but those systems do require constant maintenance. And over a 2-year period, you're going to have traversing of equipment there. And there's also the construction traffic of the road itself. You still have, it's all construction traffic. So there are things that contribute, but I'll go back to what Reed said earlier. You can build a pavement anywhere you want to, but until you put a load on it, it will not fail. It'll sit there. It may grow grass, but it won't fail until you put a load on it. So something had to exert a load in order for it to fail. Now, did it fail prematurely? If it failed within 6 days after they did it, obviously it failed prematurely.
It was failing 6 days after.
So, I mean, obviously it failed prematurely, but it had to have a load on it in order for it to fail.
These problems has been going on since 2008, the problems with the roads.
Yes, ma'am.
And how many houses did you build on that street since that time?
That's the one digs. I don't know when they built the houses.
Okay.
We only saw when one house was built.
Anybody
as a
know
spec
how
house.
Many houses was built?
2011, I believe the first house was built.
Okay. And the houses, I was riding through there a few weeks ago, and the houses are beautiful, but the patches are atrocious. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, will there ever be a solution to that problem with the roads? Because I wouldn't buy a house over there because I think it'll have an impact on the property value if you try to sell the house again.
Well, we certainly want a solution to the problem.
Mm.
And that's what I think we're all looking toward and we're all working on. And
there have been six options recommended, and those are an increasing level of risk. And the level of risk, you can't give a guarantee of how long a road's going to last, and you never will be able to. Even pristine roads that go down, they expect to repair, go in and repair and make some patches. Not to the extent this is atrocious. I 100% agree. In fact, I've been practicing 36 years now in the southeast, and I don't think I've ever seen a roadway with that much patching and repair on it. So I do agree with you wholeheartedly. The options were limited to do nothing option, which is always an option. I mean, it is an option. You don't have to do anything. It's going to continue to look the way it is and deteriorate, and you can continue to patch. all the way down through different mechanisms for removing, repairing the subgrade, and replacing it in different options. So, you know, it's all a level of risk. You got a high level of risk if you do nothing. You're going to continue to patch and pave. And you get a lower level of risk if you do some of the full depth reclamation projects and remove and replace the subgrade. The other thing somebody wanted to know was how long, what's the guaranteed life expectancy? There is no guaranteed life expectancy with any of the solutions. However, you're reducing the risk that you're going to have to go back and make repairs within a period of time. The other thing is the construction has ceased in that area now. You should not have any more construction traffic except for the groups coming in to clean up the sediment basins and the groups that are accessing that sanitary sewer lift station. They are construction traffic. If you go in, then it might be wise for those to take a look at the CBR value that was recommended based on the test results and look at what type of pavement or asphalt system would be best suited for the conditions and for that type of loading.
So that will reduce the possibility of that.
Yes, ma'am. You're reducing, every time you do something, you're reducing the possibility or you're mitigating the amount of liability you have for continued failures.
I guess I understand your logic, what you're saying, but why isn't this happening in the within sight of this area and other areas of the city? Because the same traffic goes to clean out the sediment bases. There's places where they move hillsides to build houses with the same specification the roads are built with. And it's awful odd that in this 3,300 feet of road that all of a sudden we have a little place in the city or the county that fails in this mode. I mean, that's just simple logic. 3,300 feet out of 260 miles of roads. It's hard to believe that it's a loading problem.
Well, it's not groundwater. That's the one thing we can say. And we can also state unequivocally that the soils themselves are not unusual soils for subgrade construction for roads and or the housing, for the subgrade for the houses. The soils themselves are not bad soils. Looking at I was absolutely shocked at what I read in the report with because it's not what I anticipated. But the fact of the matter is that the data itself was pretty consistent throughout the length of both roadways, and the materials were very similar. And those similar materials indicate materials that meet South Carolina DOT road construction materials. And the densities, even though I don't know it was 100% because we don't have any tests to prove that, the densities that were measured by both the standard penetration testing of the soil boring and the Kessler dynamic cone penetrometer indicate a fairly consistent density soil that was fairly good.
In the early part of your report, you mentioned that you didn't make any of the test borings at the entryways to the neighborhood because it had rock underneath the road and road and type thing. But so obviously for those, and it's a couple of hundred feet on each entry to them, there's no failure. It looks like the rest of the roads in the neighborhood.
Those entrances look very, you're right, you went into a certain distance and they were in good shape.
Once you get past a certain point, it's rather obvious where the conditions of the subbase changed.
Well, I'm a proponent of graded aggregate base over sand clay. I get a better better product out of it. But what you're looking at is when you use rock under pavement, it reacts differently. It does.
Well, I guess the next question would be the specification they use, as you said, and as I've read, also, or SCDOT specifications, the difference would be the thickness of the asphalt.
And I'm not positive I don't think DOT allows 1.5 inches of asphalt to be placed on anything unless it's a surface wear course.
South Carolina DOT, they don't really address residential streets in their pavement design. Theirs is more heavy. But what they do mention is trying to avoid the use of that sand clay base. They say you can make the structural, when you design a pavement, you come up with is based on soil support values, reputations. There is a certain amount of, in doing a pavement design, that you put a reliability number on that pavement system. And that reliability number can, you don't design a pavement system to be 100% reliable. You couldn't afford a 100% reliable pavement system. Typically, it may be 95%, it may be 90%, and what you're saying is at the end of the design life of that pavement, you're expecting that 90%, if you use a 90% reliability, that 90% of that pavement is intact and ready for a surface or resurfacing. But 10% has failed. And that goes into it as well as the traffic loading conditions. And you come up with a structural number from that.
I understand all you're saying, and I do construction management. We use BLE out of Spartanburg in Atlanta for all of our tests on the work I'm doing. And so I guess, you know, you're saying the truck traffic is what damaged it. And then I look around the city, which I spend a lot of time on the roads in different neighborhoods. You can go over to Springstone, Stratford Hall. They've moved a lot of dirt on those lots, and those roads are not falling in. Well, they all falling in is because... Well, you can go look at the lay of the land. You know, when you see a house that's cut into the side of a hill.
Was the earthwork done before they paved or after they paved? Because I've done development myself.
I understand what you're saying. But also, whenever the developer does this or the engineer does it, they would have some idea of what they're going to do. I mean, if you go in and build your road first and then go tear it up, well, then you got what we got. And somebody's got to fix it. We're going to get better.
What concerns me here is it sounds like even before houses were built out there, there was failure.
Yes.
It was failure from the first, the first year. Now, is that failure from that early period of time still making a problem that we see today with some of these?
I would say yes, because it allowed the introduction of surface water into the subgrade that infiltrated under all of the...
So what was that failure then? Exactly. What was the failure initially? Something that wasn't done properly or whatever?
Well, one of the things we're all talking about failures that occurred, the failures that occurred that I see in the photographs that Richie had provided, were all near that basin after the first house was built. And that's an area that, based on some of the information that we've had sent, that they installed some under drainage in that area because they were having some groundwork.
Excuse me, I thought we had failures even before the first house was built. The first house was built when?
2011.
And when was the road built initially?
The road was said to be 66% completed by the city of America in 2008.
Did you say 66%
completed in 2008? That was December 3rd, 2008. On December 9th of 2008, Mr. Myers from the City Engineering Department stated road area areas of failure and asphalt service. That's 6 days after the repair.
Okay. So is this still that problem today then? That it started then? Sounds like it started then. And we're still living with it because of whatever reasons.
I would say yes, that was part of it.
If it's not a soil problem, we're saying that you're saying the heavy truck caused the thing to crack, and once that happened,
yes. It
was Katie by the door, and that's the source of all of the issues that we've faced since then. When the water goes sub pavement down the road, it's going to cause other areas to crack.
What I'm saying is...
Trying to oversimplify it, but...
I understand. I just want to clarify. I'm not saying that water didn't... That subgrade wasn't wet. I am not saying that when it was paved originally. But until loads were applied to it, it wouldn't fail. Now, if it failed because the subgrade was wet, it accelerated, and then from there, it was Katie bar the door once you started getting cracks. But there is no way at this point in time to tell if that material was wet when they paved, because the soil, the moisture contents we're able to retrieve now, and that granted they're at 18 inches because of what we can effectively measure, those soil water contents are not high enough to indicate to me that the overriding factor was the overall pavement system being too wet or the subgrade being too wet.
How about the quality of the pavement? I mean, are you able to look at...
I don't know how much of that pavement out there is original. Everything looks like it's been replaced.
But I understand, but and again, not an engineer, but wouldn't it make sense that there's good pavement, there's medium good pavement, there's bad pavement? I mean, do we have good pavement here?
Based on what we've seen out there, we haven't seen indication that it's a paving. There's not a stripping issue. There's no segregation. The paving generally appears, just based on visual observation, to be reasonable.
Okay.
And nothing really to indicate that pavement breakdown.
You would know if the pavement was bad or if it was not thick enough?
Well, we cut the cores to determine the thickness and measured the thickness.
Okay.
And verified it was 1.5.
And is 1.5 okay as far as you're concerned?
Bring me a
lot. That's a
thin section. Gotta expect a few loaded questions.
That is a loaded question.
That's a thin section.
It is very thin.
It is a thin section.
I mean, what
I would tell you, some research is other municipalities in this area. I looked at Columbia's, I looked at Augusta. They recommend a minimum of 2 inches. I can tell you, as you get more up into the Piedmont, I've worked a lot up in the Charlotte area and over towards Greenville, and there they require a minimum of 3 inches. Now, those 3 inches are put down in usually two layers, and it's put down. And I can tell you, you don't pave until you finish your lot grading because the amount, the weight in particular.
See, I don't understand that because I was told that before you issue a certificate of occupancy to a house, you got to have the road done. Is that not true?
Mm-hmm. It is true.
So but now you got still, the chicken and the egg.
Mass grading is what he's referring to. We're not talking about box spreaders moving around a foot of soil for a house. We're talking about cutting 15, 18 feet of soil out and moving it to another location. The type of equipment you use for that type of grading operation is different than what a contractor normally uses around a house to level out a lot for construction or final landscaping. It's different equipment, it has different weights, it has different capacities, and a different use.
Is there anything about the sprinkling system and the flow of water, if the water is coming down from the house into the street, or the sprinkler systems are operated too often? Any of these other peripheral things part of the problem?
Once you get the cracks down the seams, as long as there's a path for that water to get up underneath the pavement, it's inducing water into the pavement system, and it's going to create a softening of the subgrade.
Also, if you have grading to the back of curb where you allow ponding of water at the back of curb, it will follow that interface along the curb and go right up under the pavement. So if you allow sprinklers to run incessantly along the edge of pavements, even between the lip of the gutter and the asphalt, right at the edge of the paving, if it sets there, it'll go down in there, and that will cause a premature failure. Columbia County in Georgia has experienced that severely by virtue of sprinkler systems.
But you know, we have this condition all over the city.
Yeah.
We have sprinklers and roads and that. And I guess, you know, forgive me for being hung up on why is this 3,300 foot such bad shape. Other roads, I can go down just about any road and you're going to see hairline cracks down it. And I understand the hairline crack didn't start at the top, it started at the bottom. And for some reason, the water must drain out under them when they're building houses. Because there's a lot of roads in neighborhoods that's still going to have dirt moved on them.
I have roads, Ms. Ebner, that I put in over 15 years ago that have not even had the first crack sealing. And they were on 8 inches of sand clay and 2 inches of asphalt without any problems whatsoever. I know exactly what you're talking about. This is not, I mean, we've designed a bunch, and that's a standard over in Richmond County and Columbia County. But the that they work for a lot of reasons. One, the material was absolutely pristine that they put in. All the compaction techniques were handled appropriately. The water, the material was at the optimum moisture content. The pavement was put down appropriately. The stormwater drainage from the pavement surface and the surrounding lots was handled appropriately, and they haven't had any problems.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes, sir.
I want to apologize, first of all, for being a little bit late, but I had an earlier meeting, and distance caused me to not get here on time. I have a series of questions and concerns. First of all, Mr. Sewell, thank you, and thank you, Jim Lakes. Is the road repairable?
Oh, yes.
What would it take?
A lot.
What's a lot?
I haven't gone through all of the options and applied costs to them yet, but it's, Councilwoman Price, it really depends on what level of risk that the city is willing to assume or the developer is willing to assume on the road. It could, like I said, we could do nothing to replace all of it, take up the base and some of the subgrade and go back in, make sure the material is at the right and the proper moisture content, compact it, put in a new base, which I would recommend, and we did recommend a graded aggregate base and then 2 inches of asphalt.
That's where I'm leading right now. We've met with you all at Dim Lakes. We've toured your area in Dim Lakes. You live this problem every day. You don't ride down your street without realizing there is a problem. We can do nothing and let you all just come to meetings every month and listen to you. We can do something, and that something would be sharing the cost with the developer. Or I don't want to end up, and I'm going to be very candid, in litigation with this, because that's where this is going to eventually lead. So where can we, how can we work together to make this work? We're getting data on top of data. We're having discussions on top of discussion. And I don't know whether you're tired of it or not, but you live this. And certainly you're at the point now where you're trying to figure out who is, and maybe you know who's responsible. I don't know. Who is responsible, and how can we work this out? But also, there's a bigger question, because we've got other areas that we've got to deal with in terms of, if we do this, are we leading to other concerns that may get us into the same box we're in right now? So it's a bigger problem than what we can imagine before.
But the report, as it summarized, quite frankly, as I heard Mr. Toole, we can't go back and say whether or not the ground was wet when the pavement was put down. And if you can't do that, you have to deal with what you have. And what you have is a road that is unsatisfactory for a lot of reasons. I don't know how you go back to the developer with that, because nobody can prove the condition of the road when he put the pavement down. So the liability, I guess it would come to the city. I'm not sure where. I'm not speaking for the city, but just a comment. I mean, it's got to be fixed. It's certainly not their fault.
Right. So it's not. They're just living with the problem every day.
If they've lived with it, they should have to pay for it. And if anybody's going to pay for it, unfortunately, if you can't prove it was a developer, and your report pretty well does that in my mind. I don't know if I'm correct in making that assumption, but the only thing that I heard you say that could be the developer's fault is if he put the pavement down when it was wet, and nobody knows, and certainly there's a lack of a city inspection report that says that, but Rick may weigh in on it. But
and what we do know, though, Dick, is that there were failures before there were any, what, 2 or 3 years before there was the first house.
Right. Correct.
And that's one thing we
know. Well, the gentleman in the back wanted to address it, and I think I'm tired of waiting, but because he's in the first house. So
I've asked him if he wanted to speak.
Rick, he addressed my concern, which is, if this inch and a half of pavement and there's still going to be running construction traffic, i.e. get to the drainage ponds there, then would that pavement have to be better than what it was originally designed for anyway, because it's going to have ongoing construction traffic forever?
Yeah.
Okay. So, thank you.
A couple of comments. I think Dick DeWar and myself and the mayor have had a rather spirited discourse this morning on moving forward and how to move forward with this. And I think that there's blame aplenty for everybody.
Correct.
The city for not doing the compaction testing, the city for not halting that construction when they were paving on wet subgrade, puts them in the middle of it. the fact that the contractor, that the developer, Gall and Kisner, did one house and then sold the lots to another contractor and then allowed the contractor to use his roads with his heavy equipment puts him right in the middle as well. He had every option to say, stop, this is my road, you get that heavy equipment off my road, I'm not going to allow you to tear up my roads. He didn't do that. So we've got all these things milling around and going around and around and around, and Dick DeWar felt that we should work towards an objective of solving this problem, and I certainly agree with you, Dick. I think that's essentially what we need to do. The question that I have in terms of the timeline on this is establishing how do we proceed from here? If you're telling me that that improper compaction, paving on a wet subgrade, and other practices that were in not really almost a minimal amount of macadam that would have done the job correctly, if all of these are present, then you have to establish, well, what is going to fix this? Is just milling up the top 2 inches of macadam and putting on a cap going to do it when we don't address underneath? Yeah, because if we don't address underneath, I just traveled that road 2 days ago, and I think I've sent you the pictures that I sent. Within 3 days of the last round of repairs, there are massive failures in Moultrie and on Huron. 3 days after they got done with their latest patch and run scheme, we now have sections where it's alligatoring and collapsing again. I mean, to say that we can then somehow maybe just, well, we'll just patch, I think that was one of the options, we'll just patch what's there and then we'll put a 2-inch overlay on it. These roads have had overlays all over because I don't even know where the overlays are anymore. And nobody does, which is why I requested that data from the contractor so we know what we were dealing with. If we're just going to put a 2-inch overlay in and not solve whatever is underneath, well, you know, the old saying is, you know, the house has to have a good foundation under it or it's not going to be very well built at the end of the day. And so that's my concern, is that we address this and not try and run away from the conclusion that I made, that there's serious issues underneath this road that have caused this road to collapse now for what? I've lost track of time. For 7 years, there has never been a period of more than a month or two when that road was not in some sort of failure. 7 years of this.
Mr. Mayor, I've got a quick question. Are city roads, well, not necessarily you, no. I would expect George Grant to answer, are the city roads load limited?
I'm not aware of any limits on weight other than, you know, the state has some bridges that they put weight limits on.
Yeah, bridges.
I'm not aware of any restrictions on any of the roads.
Mr. Toole can verify, but to my knowledge, and I've asked the question and had it verified, the design we use is a lightweight HC20 or IHC20 design from SCDOT.
I don't think it even meets HC20, but it's a lightweight design.
That's what I've been told, and I've all.
The other way that the city was culpable in this disaster, it was that performance bonding is put in place on a city road on a construction project to ensure that the citizens, not the city, but the citizens are protected against a contractor who abdicates on his responsibility. There was no bonding. When there's no bonding, this puts a severe constraint upon city employees on what course can they follow. Well, the roads aren't there, but gee, we can't take them over. The deal is when the bonding goes in, the city is to require to give an inspection on this road, give the contractor 90 days to make any repairs that are necessary if there are deficiencies, and then they can release the bond. But there was no bond. Why wasn't there a bond? There was no performance bond on this road. The maintenance bond was released.
There weren't bonds on Woodside either.
The bond was released. So And this is state law, that you have a bond at 125% of the value of the infrastructure improvement. This is a state law. I'm sure the attorney, Mr. Smith, would confirm that, that this is what the state law says, 125% of the value of the infrastructure. And so when he got to the end, there was an interesting email from Mr. Kisner to the extent of, well, do I need a bond before I get my final inspection? Well, no, you've already done it. It's like, yeah, the bond goes before you go in there and rip the place up, and you have that bond in place so that when the contractor doesn't get the job done, the city is to take over the road, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Take that project over and use the proceeds from the bond to do the repairs. This is the whole point of having the bonding, is so that the citizens are protected against this sort of disaster. As far as the rest of it goes, this road is illegal as it stands, or it's not to regulations as it stands, because the city does not permit a private road to be in the city of Aiken. This road is still a private road 7 years after it was built. We're living on a private road. If the city doesn't fix this road, take it over, or do something at this point, and if Gall and Kisner say, we're done, we're a corporation, we'll declare bankruptcy, then I'm responsible for it. Every citizen on that road is responsible for whatever it costs to take care of that road and maintain it. I didn't sign on for that. There is no HOA in that development. So, you know, I might be going to my neighbors the next time and saying, hey, you got $20,000, you got $20,000, you got $20,000, because we need to come up with $100,000 to repair this road, which is collapsing in heat. Not supposed to be. And I agree with you. I don't want to see litigation either.
Right.
But I'm ready to do it.
That's what I figured.
Mr. Clem has already 160-some-odd pages of documentation. I have more. I'm ready to proceed forward. I need this resolved. I'm tired of it.
Mr. Barrett, I have a question. Please.
What?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
What would it cost to fix the road? Estimate. We won't hold you to it on record.
I had just started putting together the cost estimates when the barrage of questions started coming in and the
okay.
request for information. I had to put everything down to just respond, and I still owe some information to Mr. Clem.
Okay.
But I'm guessing you're talking about slightly south of $1 million.
We estimate that the last week off. I just wanted to know that that's changed.
Yeah, what was the general report you gave on the surface when you did just a surface analysis almost 3 years ago was $1.2 million to fix it. And I, please forgive me, but I don't think if you took off the asphalt that's there and put 2 inches down on top of what's there, even though your tests are showing it's 2 inches are going to crack too. It's got to have the whole thing fixed. There's too many fissures down in there, and too many cracks have already happened all through the road.
It's going to take taking everything up and just starting all over again.
His tests show that. I mean, they were too varied across there. And if you did even more tests and took some cross sections every so often with two or three tests, it would show a variance across the face of the road. In the work I do, that's how we do it. We do it on a 6-foot center. Of course, it's an industrial foundation, and you spend the money to do it. I'm not recommending to do that here. But his data definitely says that there's some fissures down through the backfill, without a doubt. And you've said that with a different claim.
It's been said in the past that Mr. Decker wants the roads ripped up and replaced. Mr. Decker wants nothing of the sort. Mr. Decker loathes the fact that we're going to go through a year of or more of just absolute chaos out there if you have to rip these roads up. Mr. Decker would be more than happy if they could just put some patches in an overlay on and solve the problem. I'd be a happy kid, you know. But I don't think that's going to do it for us. And that's my concern.
Right.
In all of your reports, in the first four options, if all of them said ongoing maintenance, more maintenance, it's like, what did that mean when you defined it as ongoing maintenance? Does that mean that every 6 months we're going to have more failures and perhaps, and we're going to have to be in there fixing it again? It's like, that's
4 years to fix it.
You want to start with that?
I mean, with those options, there is an element of risk there because you haven't eliminated everything, gotten down to the base, to the bottom, repaired it, and bring it up. And as long as you don't do that, you've got that risk. It's hard to assess and give you a specific dollar amount and how often. But
I guess following up what Leslie said and what I've been promoting, and one thing she said, this is we have some other areas of problems, but the good news on other areas, it's only on top of water lines. It wasn't compacted. The sides are pretty good. Here, the whole base is failing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I come from the ground up on working with this stuff. And I guess, Mr. Mayor, and I've talked to a number of other people in relation to this. There are some legal people living in that neighborhood that have prosecuted this type of thing, and of course they've recused themselves. And I've personally been to LLR and to the Attorney General about this, and it's an internal problem, no question about it. But I think we have to come up with a solution. There are people that have tried to sell their house, and the appraisal has a deduction on it for the quality of the road. So I mean, it's really getting in their pocketbook. And so, and that LLR would tell you that once you're damaged, if you will, using the word damage to the person, then you're in a whole different ball game. And I think the city attorney can attest to that.
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by LLR.
Labor License and Regulation Board.
I understand that, but I mean, you're talking about a claim against Gall and Kisner?
Well, it's
not. LLR doesn't have any authority over the city of Aiken.
They're at fault. But yet, all along, everything they've done has been pretty well approved by the city. And then you get into not having the bonds and the other things that were not done. And Mr. Decker said it, there's a lot of blame to spread around.
Well, I don't disagree with that.
But LLR, Labor License Regulation Board, which everybody has to deal with, when it comes to a quality issue of a installed item by a municipality, and you can trace the quality back to day one, it's got to be fixed by somebody.
I slightly differ, Reggie. I think we can't prove that it was wet when they put the pavement down. 1.5 inch, you guys would have done it, but there's no rule that says it's bad, is there?
That's what was on the plans.
Okay, so I don't know how you get into the developer in that particular issue.
Mr. Dwarf, if I could, I attended a meeting back in 2013 on behalf of the city with then City Engineer Larry Morris, George Grinton. I believe Richard Pierce was at that meeting with the developers, their engineer, and a representative from CSRE testing. And it was Tilden Hildebrandt actually prepared a memo after that meeting, forwarded to Steve Kisner and Todd Gall. Now, this was provided to me by the city engineering department, so I got this from you. And it basically said, after visiting the site and as a follow-up to our meeting last week with city engineering staff, Rick Toole with Toole Engineers and Jeff Pope with CSRE testing, offer the following. A discussion was held on each of the following topics: cause of failure, testing and review of the conditions to date, evaluation of the repairs to date, and future plans. Under the first one, in cause of failure, and this is from Tilden Hildebrandt, and Councilor, this is your piece. It says, it is apparent that the pavement has failed in various locations based on excess moisture in the subgrade. The specific source of this moisture has not been determined. The subgrade has been moist but not saturated in the core samples that have been examined. It was theorized that the moisture near the surface at some point in time was exacerbated by heavy truck traffic moving soil from lot to lot. So he goes on to say a few more things. But it was recognized early on, and even admitted to by the engineer for them, that there was the subgrade was wet, and they were attributing some of the failure or the failure to that. By their engineer, plus the excess heavy traffic.
That changes the complexion then. Yeah, okay, then we do have legal recourse.
Mm-hmm. City engineers maintain that too.
Yeah.
Well, if you're building something and you know it's wrong as you're going along, you're supposed to fix it just either both by ethics and by being a professional engineer, which I'm one. And I know Mr. Tilden Hillebrand very well from working with him over the years. And this we've got to come together with a solution. And unfortunately, it's solution number 5 or 6 to get any kind of life out of the road at all. And, you know, around town, we usually say, Mr. Morris and Mr. Lew and myself would say, a road that lasts 15 years is okay, but you're looking at 20 to 25 years for a typical road. And, yeah, you can get 10% patches or so. But I guarantee you, if somebody said, I got a road failure, I want to go look for the low spot in the roads. That's where it's going to fail. And you know that as well as I do. So we have an area here that we got guilt. It's been said, we got to come up with a solution. I guess that's...
Well, I don't think there's any doubt we need to come up with a solution. We've talked about this in all of our many meetings, and I think we all know that. And we want this road fixed. We want to fix it. And if we have to do it, we're going to have to do it and make it right, as far as I'm concerned. I understand that.
Okay.
John. Who wanted to talk? John.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Back to one of the points that Mr. Decker made, and that is whether or not we have our finger on the real cause of this failure. Because obviously someone is going to spend a lot of money, whether it's the developer, whether it's someone else, or whether it's the city, or a combination thereof, someone's going to spend a lot of money. Wouldn't we look even more foolish if 5 years from now we were having a meeting, having repaired the road, to have it fail again?
Right.
So my question to both of you, in terms of level of confidence, we're not engineers, that's why we hired you.
Right.
What is your level of confidence that you have put your finger on the cause? Because I don't want to solve a problem without understanding what the problem was. And I think that that's what Mr. Decker was getting at. But I need to ask you that. We're talking about spending real dollars here. Mm-hmm. I want to feel some level of confidence that we have a fix on this thing before we spend a lot of money.
Well, we could.
We have two.
Here's two people.
Relate that to the option. So in answering this question, whatever your answer is, you reflect that back towards option 1, 2, 3, so on and so forth. So what is the best solution?
Since I haven't had an opportunity to go through and assign those levels of risk or to articulate a level of risk plus cost, I would like to defer that question, if I could, until I've had time to...
But do you feel that when you have been given sufficient time, that you will make a recommendation to this body with a high level of confidence that you have got your finger on the pulse of what caused this, so that we're not solving a problem without understanding what the problem was?
Yes, sir.
And the only other comment that I would make is that I didn't realize our attorney was here, and I'm glad that he is. But before we get into too much more discussion about liability and whether if the testimony that we've received is accurate, and I believe that it must be, that this road failed after the first house was built, how anyone could sit here and say that it is not the developer's responsibility is absolutely beyond me.
Right.
Yes, sir.
I have a question that might relate to what you're talking about.
Does it come to the mic?
I heard you talk about the fact that you didn't know whether it was done in lifts. When you took the core sample, were you able to determine that the lower, bituminous material was like an aggregate, more aggregated, and then the top was finer? Were you able to see that in the core?
No.
So what you're thinking is that it was done in one lift. And in some areas you show 3.1 inches, which in fact is rolling at least 4 inches of blackout.
Right.
In my view, that is not an acceptable way to roll. If you watch rollers, which I have for a lifetime, and especially when they're pulling a hill, it looks like they're pulling over a mattress when the blackout is too thick. And typically a contractor will vary the thickness to try to do a final grade, which to me is a very expensive way to go. I'm curious as to why he didn't do a better job initially to, you know, prepare so he didn't have to pay for so much blacktop. So you're not, did you really test on the core to see if the core actually could have failed as well, that the actual blacktop, you did not? So maybe we're looking, that could be like a, you know, red herring here. We're looking at something that like you touched on. We're not looking at the real problem. If they're, I know that if they're tamping, even with a big vibrating tamper, and typically you do that without the vibrator the first time, then you go back and you do it to really get a good, but if they're putting it over wet soil or subbase, then that's going to cool that product down pretty good underneath. Additionally, you can't tamp 4 or 5 inches of blacktop, you know, successfully in one, you know. Where I have some experience was like in parking lots and stuff like that, where they did definitely do it in 2 lifts. But this obviously was not spec that way, and it was, I guess they just said 1 lift. But you've got a lot of spots that are very thick. Do you think there's a possibility?
Patches.
They're all patches. So you're not able to find any original.
It's overlays and patches.
If you're all patches, then you really don't know whether the pattern was made originally or it's just that. If you're telling me that it was supposed to be 1.5 inches, but we got 2, we got 3, we got 3.5.
We've got some areas out there that are 1.5 inches.
Well, we got some areas, but we don't know all areas. We have some areas that are not 1.5 inches. Yeah, there's sub-1.5 inches. And then we have patches on top of them, and the measurement was including the patch, so we don't know what the original, we couldn't determine that.
Well, if it was a patch, they took out the original pavement and came back with asphalt.
Well, we wouldn't have done that with a patch.
I don't know if they did an overlay. We saw some areas that they had overlay, but I don't know if they patched anything during that overlay period. I wasn't out there, and I don't have any information about how they did their patches or how they did their overlays, what they did in that time process. But I will say, in answer to your question, in all fairness, you are correct. I wouldn't put down 4 inches in line with SCDOT allowing it to. I think the only thing we can offer is just, one, it's a patch, so it was added asphalt. Secondly, there was no evidence of rattling, stripping of aggregate, segregation, or any type of aggregate accumulation at the bottom of any of the cores based on what he's indicated me and what we've seen visually on the surface.
So your assumption is that it was rolled properly, every patch you took out, you said that was good.
It wasn't full of air voids, or he would have called me and said, we need to check it.
Right.
But to your point, rolling could create some of those initial cracks that allow.
Got to get back to the question.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we've kind of gotten off of the questions, but I think we do need to go through these questions.
If I could just make a comment.
Go ahead, Dick.
It seems to me that we've made great progress at this meeting, and what we now need is from Mr. Toole his level of confidence on the options that are in the report and the cost element of that. Mm-hmm. And then we're back as a body to decide what the next step is. And we can go through the questions, but I think we all know what we need to know to go to the next step. We need to know how confident he would be with the options that he's listed in that report, whether it's options 5 or 6, I would assume would be the only 2 viable ones, how much are they going to cost, and then as a body, we need to decide our next action.
I agree.
And so, I'll stay and answer the questions and ask the questions, but I'm
maybe
not sure
we don't need to go through these questions unless someone has some questions on this, and we still need to go through some of them.
Unless Mr. Decker wants to, a lot of them have been answered in a general format, some of them specific. Unless you want to go through all 4 pages, we will, but I don't see the value in it.
Well, if there are any other questions from anybody that need to be talked about on the paper.
I have one question, though, Jeff. What happened to all the dirt that was in that hole when
the dirt
fell?
It wound up in your sediment basin, your storm sewer detention pond.
So it just moved from underneath the road into the... Could that happen again?
No,
Anything's possible when you're dealing with a leak and you have a storm drain or sanitary sewer with leaks that would allow infiltration into it that can allow material to move. It takes a long time, but yes, it could happen again.
Do we know if there's any other leaks or any way to check for that?
Mr. Grinton's gone, but they try to check for those leaks, but I don't know how they do that. I know they depend somewhat on owners to let them know if they've got a leak or a problem.
I have one other question. When you go to the initial development engineer, do you do the CDR testing? Do you properly engineer roads? We get several sections of the report that you're supposed to get CDR testing. Was there any evidence of CDR testing was done before the road was even?
It appears that they used the standard city specification for the road. That is a correct statement.
Okay. And then on the other hand, we're saying that they didn't do any CDR testing. They just sort of used an out-of-the-box sort of design, normal design, without doing CDR testing. So how can anybody be assured this goes forth in the city from now on? How can you be assured that if the CDR testing hasn't been done, that you're coming up with the proper design? Because there's a contradiction there, you see it. It's like on one hand you're saying we need CDR testing to have a good design. On the other hand you're saying, but we didn't do CDR, not you, but they didn't do CDR testing. So how do we know?
I think Mr. Toole, the original specifications approved in 1987, and I think it's ASTM D, it's either 683 or 638, which is a tried and true proven, and it specifically states you would go at a 95% proctor, at a certain percent moisture, and then for the next the base, you'd go to 98. And that's in the specifications for the city and the state. And by Freedom of Information Act and by a city councilman and professional engineer asking for those tests, none have shown up. So I don't think there's no tests were made, at least not documented tests. I know it is, but I'm just saying the original specifications are properly used and they're used in industry also.
I'm just saying, city engineering is saying, okay, here's I'm going to be an engineer and I'm going to submit a test to city engineering for I'm going to decide a plan for a road. Would it not be logical or proper to say, well, hold on a second, where did you see the CBR testing so we know that the road is designed properly for the conditions on site? The out-of-the-box plan works in 90% of the situations. It didn't work here. If that makes any sense, they used sort of out-of-the-box cross-section and design. It's sort of a standard thing. We use it everywhere. There's the sand clay base and this, that, and the other thing. But guess what? They use it here, and it didn't work. And you don't want to repeat this. You want to come back on another project in a couple of years. I mean, this is the problem. When is it when is the city going to look at this situation and say, no, we're not doing this correctly. We need to look and examine how we process these applications, how we review the engineering drawings, how we proceed, how we test. We need to be on all of that so we don't end up here in another 2 years for the next project.
I can answer your question for you. In 2007, yours truly was over there where Mr. Toole is, stating to the city your roads were failing because you weren't doing compaction tests, okay? And that was in 2007, okay, and I got browbeat pretty hard by the city engineer as well as the city managers, because both of them are civil engineers with professional engineering license. And then all of a sudden they passed to use the engineer of record to verify the test, okay? And the engineer of record's going to do nothing but read the city specifications, and we've been using them since. But before that, they didn't use the city specifications, and in April of 2014, city manager specifically said that in the early 2000s we relieved the compaction specification for city roads. If you don't think I'm going to hang my hat on that as we go through this, it's going to hang pretty heavy over my head and Mr. Decker's head, because we've documented all this. I've been doing this in 2005 when my road fell in front of my house because of this same reason. And so, I mean, that's how we got to where we are.
But compaction's not a problem with this.
Well, but I can tell you that if he would run some cross-section on this road, he would see some fissures between the different elevations in the road base itself. And the only way you fix them is to dig it out and get a uniform cross-section. And there's other words you use, like angle of repose and the shear angles that he's got to deal with. And that's how you get a foundation. I'm doing that on the project I'm working for, and we go through those same numbers, and we use BLE, which this gentleman is aware of here. Now, that's way easy.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
Item 25, can you address that for me, please?
I'm sorry, I didn't have time to...
It says... My lot, you haven't had time to look at that.
I haven't had time to prepare a visual that I could show on that. But if you make a deep cut, you can, in fact, intercept the groundwater table, groundwater elevation with that cut. And it sounds as though that's what's happened. They've intercepted the groundwater elevation. It normally follows or mirrors somewhat the surface elevation of the ground. Mm-hmm. If you come in and cut down, you can intercept that, which means some portion of that groundwater will seep out onto the ground surface. But the groundwater is still moving in the same direction, and wherever that surface went through that cut, hypothetically, it's still there, so when it comes into the other side of the ground, it's still going, and it will dive back down to its normal elevation without that cut. I have a graphic sketch I can show you later.
Okay.
Are there any other thoughts, any other things that folks want to see?
It's done a lot, Mr. Decker, and it's not something that I encourage people to do, but you can use trench drains, slope drains, down drains, anything to intercept it to keep it from coming on somebody's yard and take care of it effectively. But if it's coming out of the bank, nothing was done to address that situation in this case. And the French drains are perfect if they put the water in the gutter. And the gutter allows that water to travel to a catch basin storm sewer system. And if the swales actually dump the water over the curb into the roadway itself into the gutter, then that is correct. That's proper. And that's standard. What we don't want is a low area behind a curb where water just sits. And if a French drain gets stopped up and it starts backing up along that curb, the same thing. It's going to come out of that area and follow the path of least resistance, which is generally an interface between two dissimilar materials like concrete or asphalt and soil.
One other question, and I'm ready to close. Another question. My question is, does the council meeting on the 10th, are you going to have a report? Probabilities
of crossing
and everything ready for the council meeting, or at least a couple
of
days beforehand, so people can
review it. I don't know if this is going to be a council meeting.
I don't know if I can have your recommendations and the level of probability and the cost prepared ahead of time. I might be able to have them by that night, and I will do everything I can to prepare them for them.
Very good. Thank you.
I will do what I can.
Well, Any other comments? Yes, sir.
I guess my concern being, moving forward from here, we're looking at your findings and recommendations. The results you have show that what's underneath the asphalt is good and it's unbothered. Moving forward, your recommendation would be then based on the results you came up with. What's under there now is sufficient moving forward. Basically, the results or recommendations off the results showing that there's nothing wrong with what's there?
No, the material itself meets specifications and is considered suitable material. The condition of the material is not good.
Y'all need to hear what he just said, because that's the key to the whole thing. Yes. Right there.
Say that again, please.
The material itself, the properties of the material itself are good. They're suitable according to SCDOT and any engineering practice. The condition of the materials is not good. Surface water seeped in and has contaminated that upper material and has caused that rapid failure and continued failure that you're seeing both in patches and other areas.
Thank you.
Okay.
Right. Right.
Mr. Busser. Sir.
One question on option one. I'm not sure we even have to look at that, just letting things go. We have to have some repair to this. We can't just spend any time looking at something that's going to just unpack it continuously.
I don't disagree with you, sir, but I mean, it's my responsibility to provide all options, and do nothing is an option. It may not be a good option, but it's still an option, unfortunately.
Well, I don't agree with that either, and I don't think anyone here agrees with that. We want, again, I'm speaking for myself, we want this road fixed properly. Now, how we get it done is still some questions about that. And we're not going to be ready to make that decision at the council meeting either, the next one. So I don't want anybody to think that we will. There'll be some information maybe that we can, and Mr. Clem has it on the agenda. But I would say, I don't think we're going to be ready to make any decisions. We've got some talking to do and some things to think about. I think Dick put it very wisely and right when he made his comments about going forward, steps forward. I would agree with what you said, Dick, certainly. But we do want to move ahead, certainly, and we want to get this thing done. But there are some questions, still some questions. Yes, ma'am.
How are the repair people chosen? Do you have bids going on, or do you present with the problem with really is, and you bidding, or?
I think maybe I make you're asking how these gentlemen were picked to do the
how
work that they've done.
Will they fix it? Huh? Who's going to fix it?
When we fix the road, how is it going?
Well, they'll go out to bid. That's a normal process.
We'll follow city procurement procedures, which will basically, you know, once a solution is selected and is designed, then that will go out for public bidding.
Can we come up with more of an aggressive timeline to come to some decision, other than we're not going to vote on it at the next council meeting? I respect that. Everybody needs some time. But can we put some lines in the sand so that at least we have some benchmarks to look forward to, and not just say, well, at some point we'll discuss this again? I mean, with all due respect, we've been talking about this for a long time.
Well, I would expect that where we may not be able to do anything at the August 10th meeting, I certainly would expect that we may be able to be a little bit more specific by the August 24th meeting.
Not only one meeting.
There's none.
September.
I would say before we reach October.
Oh, that's right. There is no August meeting. I'm sorry. The first meeting in September then, yeah.
Well, we have to determine a failure mode, just like John said earlier. You know, otherwise, I mean, we can devote all our resources to it. I mean, dig it out and find out we're not really solving a problem. And along with, you know, coming up with costs, et cetera, et cetera, is there any way you can come up with, you know, what is the failure mode as opposed to just totally coming up, you know, going back to scratch and start, you know, 15 feet under, start compacting layers, layers, layers?
I
I wish I could give you a definitive answer off the top of my head based on the information I've seen and the proposed options that Wilmer Engineering has put forth. My guess is if you're trying to look at, and the primary concern, when I think rightfully placed, is on the subgrade construction, would be a removal of the basin paving, an inspection of the subgrade, and removal of subgrade that has to be removed as a result of moisture intrusion or contamination. That needs to be monitored and directed in the field by a geotechnical engineer who knows what the heck they're doing.
Now, is option six that?
Is option six that one? I don't remember.
Option six is the complete removal and reconstruction of the road.
Yes.
But I mean, how deep are we speaking? I mean, how deep, when you say removal, are we talking about digging down to the water table?
No. You're talking about removing basin paving, which is the 2 to 4 inches of pavement that's existing.
Electrical engineer, I know electron.
The 8 inches.
But I guarantee you that's not going to work.
The 8 inches of base that's underneath that, and then evaluate the material under there to decide how much needs to be removed and replaced, which shouldn't be more than 12 inches, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Mr. Decker.
Well, one big concern to me about all of this is, you know, we're not kicking the can as we have passed down the road, but we are kicking the can somewhat down the road. I'm being told everybody agrees here that we've got to pick this problem on. We've got this various problem. We've got an election in November. We're going to have maybe new council meetings, new persons on this board. We're going to have a new mayor at that point in time. I think we need to cap this off and have a resolution that the city is going to be responsible to do whatever they got to do to fix this. It's, you know, I mean, without money, it's just going to talk about the world, you know, but what are we doing in terms of nailing it down?
Rich, you're right, but you're trying to pin us down, and we're not going to get pinned down. We need to know money. We need to know how much money it's going to cost. We need to know what the options are. I mean, we're moving forward.
So if it costs too much money, we just do what?
No. You're not going to get a definitive statement from this council tonight as to exactly what we're going to do to solve the problem. Okay? Well, we told you we'd be going to be moving quickly. And, you know, we can't have it the August 10th meeting, although it's possible, not likely, that we could have the report from Mr. Toole at the August 10th meeting, not likely. And if we don't have it then, for sure we'll have it at the first meeting in September. I expect this issue to be on the agenda almost at every council meeting until we get a course of action. But please don't ask us for information that we can't give.
I'm just saying that, you know, what concerns me is
What could we say that would make you happy?
I want a decision before the election.
The election has nothing to do with it. There's one person who's going to change the election.
What we've asked you is not to vote or make decisions tonight. Okay, what we've asked you is what any one of us would do in the real world outside of these four walls. Come up with a timeline and live up to it instead of saying, well, we're going to keep going. How many years and how many times have I stood in front of this council asking the same questions? So we're asking, okay, let's draw a line in the sand and let's say that we agree or you agree and you do whatever work in the time frame that you need to get yourself, but then you commit to delivering, and like you said, the body doesn't want to do it. That's what we need to hear. But in the same respect, we go home and deal with this every day. This isn't a council meeting for us. It's a lot of time and effort put into this. We'd like to see some of the resolution, or we'll take Plan B. None of us want Plan B, but we all know what that is.
I think you should be pleased with what we did tonight.
Okay. Well, the last time I met with the mayor and Mr. LeDoux, I asked this. If you want our patience, give us some information. How many letters have we gotten? That's been over a year.
Well, we've given you a report that pretty well highlights what it is.
We got a report from Mr. Toole how long ago?
Last week, wasn't it?
No.
Got one over 3 years ago.
We already did this before with four options. Now we have six.
Just a minute. I'll tell you the exact date we got the report, because we got the report the same day you did. It was the date that it was published.
We'll give a timeline just as soon as we can give a timeline.
Vic, I think he's referring to the meeting we had before, like a year and a half ago or so, that we had four options at that point, 1.2 million being the top, and then went nowhere. And so now we are a year, year and a half later, and now we're back to, well, we've got a report, but we don't have a figure, and so we're waiting for a figure.
Let me say a couple of things here. I'm probably not at the point that you are, because I'm not in your neighborhood every day. But I am, can I be blunt with you? I'm pretty much tired of hearing about this. I want a resolution to it, number one. It's not because I'm running. I, period, want a resolution for this. Secondly, you've got to be a little bit... have some patience with us. When I say patience, I know you've been patient already, but give us a couple of months. I would hate to come back and the larger body, the citizens of this city, said you didn't do your due diligence. You didn't study enough. Now, you may have said, you may say, we studied enough. But he's got some more information to do himself and get that back to us. I surmise we'll have something for you before October. That is where I'm coming from as a council person.
Who is going to start looking for the money? This is going to take some dollars. Is that between the city attorney and Mr. Clem, Mr. Mayor? Somebody's got to start looking in the pockets.
I would say that we'll talk about that. I don't know an answer. I don't think we have a specific answer who's going to be doing that, but we will do it.
We need
obviously, it's going to cost money. We all know that.
But I think that ought to be over here just behind saying we're going to fix it. Once we say we're going to fix it, we already ought to have a solution for the dollars, and they're not going to be small.
Well, absolutely we should.
So is that and the reason I asked the city attorney if we said involve him, we obviously have multiple parties involved here.
Absolutely.
And I would think that either the August 10th meeting or the September whatever meeting, we ought to be looking at where the pockets, which pocket we're going to take how much money out of. So,
you're right.
Very good. I'll move with adjourn.
Well, let me clarify something so no one will not misinterpret anything, and people do that. When I say that I'm tired of hearing about it, I'm tired because you're tired. I know you're tired, and you want a resolution. So we have got to do something within the next few months so that you will know where you stand. If you don't lack our response, then you know what to do next. And that's where we are.
Well, you're right. I am tired. I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours in on this project. I didn't come to Aiken to spend the rest of my life fighting
with the
city.
Right.
Something morally, ethically, should be resolved for the citizens. I am tired. But I can tell you that although there's not a huge amount of citizens here, every citizen in here, you might develop, is real tired.
I know.
Real frustrated about this because it does affect our lives.
I know.
And our children's lives.
The other question I have for you, Mr. Decker, is if we, and I'm using the word if, we decide to proceed further to with a remedy for the situation, are we going to hear from complaints from the citizens about the length of time it's going to take to do what we need to do to get it right? And that's what I need you all to think about. It's taking too long, and those kinds of things. But just think about the time it's going to take as you move forward.
All I can say is for myself, no, I understand that a project of this nature is going to take a long time.
Okay.
I hate the thought of it. This is going to be driving through money
right.
For 6 months. It's going to be terrible, but it's got to be done. This is, where we're at now is a little bit analogous to, my son or somebody breaks your window in your house, and they come to you and say, you broke my window, your son broke my window, and I say, well, are you going to fix it for me? And I say, well, no, let me know what it's going to cost first, and then I'll tell you whether I'm going to fix it or not. What I've asked for is a commitment from the council to fix this. If it costs 1.2
I'll give the counsel to the end of September, then we go on to court.
You understand that where I'm sitting here,
this counsel.
I need a commitment from the counsel. Yes, we're going to fix this because we're part of the problem. We need to solve it.
Okay.
Consideration that.
Now you, we all have one.
I didn't understand. I'm sorry.
The longer that we take, we let the road in theory continue to deteriorate. Does the cost go up?
Depends on the option. If it's full replacement, no, it's only going to go up by virtue of cost of materials and contractors' availability at this point.
It's a great time to do repairs right now because of the price of oil.
Nope.
The gas prices are not
that low still. $85 a ton on asphalt right now, and it's going up, and it's going up quickly.
I move we adjourn.
Okay. All right. All right. Thank everybody. Thank you for your thoughts and everything.
Everything I see is going on.
You're welcome. That's what I'm about. Always.
I'd like to do this.